Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. Could I say that any faster, folks? Probably could. We're also streaming live at richarddugan.com. We have the podcasts. That's what we call them now. They're not archives. They're podcasts. Both at the radio shows page of richarddugan.com, as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. And hopefully we'll be expanding that in the not-too-distant future. So check that out. Also, go to our guests' website. What is the website? I'll give that to you shortly as soon as we introduce our guest who is joining us again for the second time here on the program. We also encourage you, if you can, to support the radio broadcast financially is always great. We have a PayPal account that's set up, and the link is on the homepage as well as the missions page. If you haven't listened to many of the programs and you want to know more about what we're doing here, go to the missions page, read through, and then at the bottom of that page, there's a link to PayPal for you to support the work that we're doing here. If you're so inclined, then we greatly appreciate any and all support that that you can give us. Also, if you're listening to this interview on the radio broadcast, you might be surprised that there's more of this interview at the end of the 50 minutes. There's more. Depending upon our guest's availability, we go on maybe 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes, all based upon our guest's availability. And so we encourage you to go to what we like to call the afterview. It's the interview after the interview. It's the continuation. So go to the SoundCloud, iTunes, or radio shows page of richarddugan.com, those locations, and you can hear the interview in its entirety. All right, let's jump in here. We have a returning guest, Frank Romero, and he is joining us again from overseas, and we're going to find out exactly where this man is and why he is where he is. We'll find out about that in a moment, but I want to let you know that his latest work that we actually did an interview on last time, Love and Terror in the Middle East. It's the fourth edition. Frank Romero's my guest. Frank, thanks so much for joining us all the way from, can you tell us where you are?
I'm in actually Palestine. I'm in the West Bank, right next to Israel in the Middle East.
And I guess for our listeners, the first question is, why?
Yes, I have. I'm an activist, and the book "Love and Terror" chronicles 12 years of coming back and forth from Paris, where I'm a professor, into Israel and Palestine, where I've been organizing demonstrations and conferences to end the conflict between Israel and Palestine. Here, I'm in a special place. This is part of all of what's going on between Israel and the Palestinians. I am actually in a Bedouin village in the West Bank, and it's in a very strategic area. It's right next to Jerusalem. And what the state of Israel is doing, it is trying to kick out the Bedouins here. And so what it will do, extend out Jerusalem in the middle of the West Bank and literally divide the West Bank. So they divide the Palestinians, northern and southern Palestine, and then in Gaza. And then as we unfortunately are aware of this, trying to destroy most of the Bedouin villages. And the Bedouins have been here for 60 years. They are Palestinians, but there are Bedouins that have been here for over 60 years, and they even have land deeds that the state of Israel is trying to take from them and push them into an area and a garbage dump area, and they refuse to do that. So here I am in the village. It's called Khan el-Akmar, in the Jericho Valley, trying to work with the Bedouins. 3 weeks ago, the bulldozers came to destroy the village, and I and a bunch of activists got in front of the bulldozer. We did a sit-in. I ended up being arrested. And I was actually imprisoned for 3 days, and I was released on the condition that I leave Israel and Palestine the 27th of September. But as you see, I haven't left yet, because I feel my contribution is much greater staying here and working with the Palestinians and the Bedouins to try to stop the taking of their lands and destruction of their lands and them being jacked around to another place. And hopefully this place will be a key to bringing about a durable peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Now, the Palestinians and the Israelis have been fighting over this land for to give folks who may be odd that nobody would be familiar with what's going on there, but for how long have they been fighting over this land?
Well, it's really intensely been fighting over this land since 1948. After the Balfour Declaration and the State of Israel was formed, they were behind a green line. There have been conflict in this area since 1948, exacerbated in 1967, which was the Six-Day War, and that is when it's true that there are some of the Arab nations opposed Israel, and they're expanding into their lands. And Israel prevailed in this conflict, but what it did was, and this is the part that's in violation of international law, it has taken the West Bank, and literally from 67 up until now, over 500,000 Israeli settlers have permanently settled here, which is against all international law. And the State of Israel took Gaza, which did give it back, and then took East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, which has not given back. And it's just like the U.S. and the Allies that took over Berlin after World War II. The occupation was temporary for several years, but then under international law, you're not to bring in permanent settlers. And then eventually, once peace is found and you've organized where you're occupying, such as Berlin, that is to be given back to the original country under the condition that the security interests of the countries around have been complied with. Here, Israel has not done that since 67. In fact, if we look around where I am now, and there's these Bedouin communities, they've been here since 1952, the Bedouins. They came through the Negev Desert, southern Israel, and were pushed here. And now the State of Israel wants to push them out. Why? Because if you look around where I am now, you see a bunch of settlements, and the State of Israel wants to extend the settlements and replace the Bedouins with Israeli Jews in the settlements and kick them into a garbage bin area. So that's why the activists are here, to try to prevent that and try to bring, this is a key area, try to bring a durable peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. This conflict has gone on long enough. People have argued it's been going on longer, but I'm just focusing on the most intense part of the conflict that you alluded to, Mr. Dugan, that it's been going on before that, for sure, and you could even say hundreds of years or even thousands of years, but the intense struggle really is started after 1948.
And again, I want to ask this question. I'm not trying to be political, but I thought the Trump administration was supposed to solve this problem.
You know, he did. In fact, you're absolutely right. And you probably are one of the only people that remember one of his campaign promises.
Well, Kushner was supposed
nowadays,
to.
But he did make that commitment. He said, you know, within the first 6 months, I'm a, you know, remember he said, I make bargains. I'm a deal maker. You know, I'm going to give it all I got. And the answer is zip. He has done nothing. In fact, all he's done is the American diplomat who represents the United States has been considered to be pro-settler, so very pro-Israeli, and he has decided to throw fuel into the fire, if we could say, oil into the fire, if you will, by officially claiming Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which, you know, since many years ago, the United Nations made a decision that Jerusalem has still not been decided yet, because it's going to be part of a peace plan. It's going to be the end part of the peace plan of what happens to Jerusalem. So under the United Nations principle, it is an international jurisdiction, and that's why no embassies were in Jerusalem. And Mr. Trump decided he's going to throw, oil on the fire, and decides to switch the American embassy to Jerusalem to claim Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, completely ignoring the Palestinian interests. So to answer your question, Mr. Dugan, he's done all but exacerbate the conflict. He's done mostly that, other than trying to find a durable police peace solution here. And police, maybe I'm using, that's a Freudian slip. But in any case, no, he's done nothing. In fact, he's made things much worse.
Now, you've been over there for how long? I don't mean this specific period of time, but how long have you been involved in trying to bring about through whatever efforts that you're engaged in, some kind of resolution between these two parties?
I've been going back and forth for 12 years. Started out right toward the end of the Second Intifada up until now. This is actually the first time, and I lived with the Bedouins for 3 weeks. I came about a month and a half ago. This is the first time I'm working direct with Bedouin Palestinians and focusing on the Bedouin issue. And it's a microcosm. If I were to show you a video right now, I'm right next to the tent. And inside the tent, there's probably over 100 people that are here in solidarity with the Bedouins. And you're going to see a lot of Palestinians here, because a lot of Palestinians that are not Bedouins have also lost their land and homes to Israeli settlers. So they empathize with the Bedouin issue here of losing their lands and being jacked around to another area, which is actually happens to be a sewage plant area where the state of Israel wants to put them and take their lands. But there are a lot of Israeli Jews here as well who are in solidarity with the Bedouins and with Palestinians in general. So this is not just a Bedouin issue. This is a key area, right? Because again, if this place falls to the state of Israel and they build more settlements here, it's going to effectively cut the West Bank into two, and therefore Palestine into North, South, West Bank, and Gaza, three places, which really indicates that the old classical strategy of divide and conquer is still alive. But if you look around here in the tent, and it's nighttime here, and you see lights, there's lots of people here from all over the world, and many Israeli Jews here in solidarity that do not agree with what their government is doing. So, Mr. Dugan, I've been doing this, I'm going back and forth for 12 years in Israel, and in the West Bank, Ramallah, focusing on bringing a durable peace, bringing Muslims and Jews and Christians together in both areas, involving in demonstrations. But again, this is the first time with the Bedouins, but it really is a microcosm for all the Palestinian struggle to have their country, to live a normal life instead of under this terrible occupation, or if I'm talking to people in Gaza, this asphyxiating blockade.
Now, some people who, again, are not that familiar with the details of what's been going on for 50 or more years, some might say, well, you know, Frank, isn't this just over a piece of land? I mean, come on, this is just land, and life is too precious to waste dying over a piece of land. Help me to understand the focus and reason for this conflict.
That's a very appropriate comment, and it's just very complicated here.
Okay.
And I thought very similar. Yeah, this is just a small portion of land, but there's something about the Holy Land, and it's not. I thought, well, yes, Jesus was here, the prophets were here, Muhammad was here. When he rose to God from the Temple Mount area. No, it's not about that the prophets were, Abraham was here and Moses was on his way here, right? It's not about that. It's an epicenter. For some reason in the Holy Land, it's an epicenter for world conflict or world peace. It's a lot more than just land. There is culture here, traditions that sometimes are very harmoniously working together, and other times there's great conflict, and religion's very much involved here.
You are an American citizen?
Yes, a French-American.
French-American, okay.
Yes.
Originally
American.
All right. Why does Frank Romano care about what's going on in Israel between the Palestinians and the Jews and, of course, now the Bedouins in this conflict? I mean, you know, you come back to America, you could teach, you could just, you know, not put your life at risk because, quite honestly, I don't know that I'd want to be anywhere near that area because the potential for loss of life is, unfortunately, is very high from what we've been seeing in the media.
Well, you know, it's true. And activists have made sacrifices because it's not like I'm here as a tourist or for charity and I have a bleeding heart. Long time ago, Mr. Dugan and I took a trip 30 years ago. I was studying Paris at the Sorbonne. I was depressed. I'm a country boy, and here I'm in the big city. And the dream told me, get out of Paris and head to the Middle East and do something about peace. It was something like that. And so I headed out in 1978. So this has been going on a long time. So like a calling. I got as far as Casablanca, in, you know, in Morocco, in northeast and northwestern corner of Africa. And I walked into a mosque to learn about Islam because I knew once I got to the Holy Land, I'll be working with Muslims. I didn't know much about Islam. I knew a lot about Judaism and Christianity, so I have Christian and Jewish roots. And I walked into the wrong mosque, though, in Casablanca to learn about Islam. I walked into a jihadist group, and they held me captive, and then I ended up having to escape and return to Paris a couple months later, not being able to arrive at the destination, which was the Holy Land, to carry out the calling. So this was the beginning of me trying to carry out a calling. So many years later, I'm going to fast forward. I went back to the States in the meantime, became a lawyer, then returned to Paris, got my doctorate, became a professor. In the back of my mind, I always thought, was this calling? Was this dream just another of my fantasies, or was it real? So I decided this time, and now later, like 25 years later, again, I'm back in Paris. I'm a teacher, and I'm a professor at the University of Paris. And I decided, well, let me find out. So I, instead of going through North Africa, because before I didn't have the money to take a plane, I just took a plane from Paris. It's a three-hour trip as opposed to going through the gauntlet of traveling down to Africa and then across Africa, which would have taken me a couple of months to get to the Holy Land. But as you know, I didn't get there before. Now, this time I just took a 3.5-hour plane trip from Paris to Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, and I was there in Israel, in Palestine, which was my destination before, which I didn't get to. And that was in 2005, and it's been magical ever since. I've been going back and forth 5 times a year and doing a lot of interfaith work, Muslim, Jews, and Christians, like I alluded to before, Mr. Dugan. And it's all chronicled in the book Love and Terror in the Middle East, 4th edition. Again, this is the first time I'm working with Bedouins. So to answer your question, it derived from that dream. So this is a real calling. This is part of me. And then globally, and I know we've talked before, and I think you believe the same thing. I remember us discussing this. What I'm doing here is what everyone should really think about doing anywhere in the world where they're suffering. And I allude this metaphor to the avatar roots, where everyone is connected. So even though this could be far away from the United States, it is, but it has all to do about us, because people are being discriminated against, people are being persecuted, and it could be us someday. So wherever that happens in the world, we cannot simply say, what did that have to do with me? What did it have to do with the price of beans to feed my kids? It's all about who we are. There's someone who needs our help. We need to try to do what we can, because tomorrow it could be us as well. We're all linked. So it comes from to answer your question, it comes from a personal calling. But it also, I think globally, I feel like the avatar tree, we're called and we're linked, and we got to help each other globally. And I believe we discussed that, and I felt in my heart that you kind of shared that notion.
Well, we've got to step up and do something, and I'm doing my little part here in my corner of the United States. But
this is a big part.
Yeah, two things.
I don't want to interrupt you. Just a second. What you're doing is huge, because if it weren't for people, interviewing us, getting the word out, no one would know about it. You're just, in fact, what you're doing, Mr. Dugan, I promise you, this is not condescending talk. It's just as important as what we do, because the word doesn't get out. These interviews don't get out, and this interview will go out on the internet. People will be able to listen to it. No one would know. No one is going to be able to share or have empathy of what's going on without the interviews. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No. I just want to correct you on one point.
Yes.
My father is Mr. Dugan. I'm Richard, and so you can go ahead and refer to me as such. That's fine.
Okay. Richard.
But the
okay.
other thing that I find so fascinating is this vision that you had. Can you? You've described it, I think, sufficiently. I'm just curious, from your perspective, where'd that vision come from?
Well, it did come from an initial dream, and you know, we all have dreams, and so it came from a dream. It was so powerful that within, and again, that dream took place when I was studying philosophy at the University of Sorbonne University in Paris. It was so powerful and so clear that within a month, I gave up my school, I gave up my job, I was a waiter in a breakfast place near the Sorbonne in Paris, and I took off. There's something about this. And, you know, if each of us, I think, has a calling, and if we listen to that and we have to prioritize, because sometimes we get distracted by things we think are a calling that aren't, and find out if something is that powerful. And again, I think we all have a calling. How am I going to find out, I thought to myself, Richard, how am I going to find out if it's true or not unless I do it? And so I just, I just went for it and decided I'm just going to have to find out. This is important. And I've not regretted it, even though I was in danger with the jihadist group. That was the initial motivation to do what I do now. And it's clear that was a message. It wasn't just a fantasy.
Well, there's an element here in the United States that is, to me, sort of exacerbates the problem. And it's not just the administration, because I felt the same way of thinking, why are you poking the bear? How volatile Jerusalem is to at least the Muslims and the Christians. It would be like the Baha'is, of which I was a member of that faith for a year and a half back in the early 90s, moving their International House of Justice from Haifa to Jerusalem. You know,
right.
That would, I think, if I may use the phrase, that would piss off a lot of people, too, in spite of the fact that
the
Baha'is are a very peace-loving people. But here in this country, we have radio and television commentators who are just, you know, there are those who are this is the terminology that's used. They're very pro-Israel. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. So are you telling me that the Palestinians, and in this case, because now you're talking about a third faction of the Bedouins, are these not human beings, too? And I do understand the importance of the land. I live in Santa Barbara, live up on the hill above Santa Barbara, and the property on which we live has been threatened at least 7 or 8 times by wildfires, but it's never reached us since 2006. And so my wife and I feel as though we're under this protective bubble. I don't know that the land is really that sacred or special or blessed, but nonetheless, there you go. There's the history.
Yeah.
So
yes.
When you're talking about a piece of land with the kind of history that let's focus, I guess, on the city of Jerusalem, that piece of land, you have some history there. There's no question.
Yes. Yeah.
In terms of your experiences thus far, and we did talk about this the last time you were on the program, which was, by the way, October of 2017. So it's a little over a year. From your perspective, in spite of the administration's poking the bear, if you will, or throwing gasoline on the fire, what progress have you seen that your efforts and those of others who are there firsthand in that area, has there been any progress, or has it been nothing but a setback since the announcement of the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem?
Well, they're like, you take 2 steps forward, 1 step backwards, Richard. I see there's a lot of working together with activists worldwide that it wasn't so much when I started in 2005. And it's not just about me. A lot of activists have gotten busy and got the word out. The media's covered it. But it's a slow progress. It's a so slow process, and so my, you know, your statement and it was kind of questions embedded in it was like of several tiers of question there, but you see, my calling was to go here, and it didn't matter what this is Jerusalem. It could have been Timbuktu, it could have been in Nigeria if that was where I was supposed to go. I didn't even matter really where or what the situation was, if it's unstable or not. I try not to bring myself into a war zone, but this happened to be my calling. And then wherever it is, that's where I have to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I see, though, that this particular place, Khan el-Ahmar, that's K-H-A-N and then A-L, then A-H-M-A-R, is actually on the map now because of the activists have got involved. Even the European Union Parliament made a decision that if the state of Israel was to destroy this place, it would be a war crime. There's some powerful people that have come on board, thanks to journalists as yourself, thanks to, you know, talk shows as yourself. I mean, I wouldn't label you a journalist, but like a talk show host, programs to get the word out. This has stymied the state of Israel for a while. And even the European Union has come across, the leaders there and other countries in the world have condemned the state of Israel. I right now, since I was jailed and released on the condition I was supposed to leave the 25th of September. Well, as you can see, I'm still here. In other words, I am now illegally here. But I've decided that my work is far more useful being here. I've given up my professor position. Notice I'm not even getting my salary anymore. I've given that up. In a year or two, I'll retire anyway, realizing that I'm more useful here and just trying to make end meet than leaving. That's how strongly I believe in what's happening here as so key. And you don't think of the sacrifice. It's a lot more about land. It's a key place that could be the beginning of the rollback of this terrible occupation by not all Israeli Jews. It's the government has gone rogue. You know, the government has gone way pro-Israeli, very, very super conservative and very discriminatory. They've treated acts, atrocities, and it's almost ironical that now even Germany has condemned, the state of Israel. And they've supported the European Union Parliament decision that, ironically, now it's Israel committing war crimes. To allude back to the Holocaust. That is not all Jews in the world. That's not a lot of Israeli Jews, that many of them are against their government. But the government is still in power, and the shoe is on the other foot here for other reasons that we don't have time to get into, Richard. It's gone really crazy, and it's been taken over by the far right pro-settlers, very hateful, anti-non-Jew people. Really, and they are the ones that are the Orthodox Jews in the settlements around this area that are trying to take the land and pressure the state of Israel to do it, and they very well could do it. This place is scheduled for demolition this weekend. Now, there have been warnings, and it may or may not happen because of pressure, but again, the progress that have been made is more and more activists are working together. When I came here a month ago, I was the only one sleeping. Of course, that was a time when the Israeli Supreme Court had suspended any demolition. And then as soon as then I left, then 3 weeks later, the Israeli Supreme Court approved the demolition of this area, saying that the state of Israel had the right to do it. The day later, I was here. And every day there's over 100 people sleeping here, staying here. And again, we blocked the bulldozer. We were imprisoned and we risked a lot by doing that. But it was very important, I believe, a nonviolent protest, nonviolent actions to stop what this cruel and atrocious Israeli state is doing. Unfortunately, with the unbridled support of the U.S., if the Israel was not getting so much money, $3 billion of our tax dollars and a lot of reductions on warplanes and so forth, it would not act so much as an impunity. So the United States, sorry to say, our government in particular, is very much an accomplice to what the state of Israel is doing here.
And unfortunately, that's a all too common occurrence down through history.
Yes.
You have these kinds of things going on. And again, we're not here on this program, we're not taking sides. We're trying to understand what's going on. You have three different philosophies that are grappling for this land, if you will, and for the right to exist. And I know that in, 1948, Israel became a state, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so what was the state of the Palestinians, because I don't know that there's ever been a place called Palestine per se for any length of time. What was the state of the Palestinians prior to Israel becoming a state and occupying a particular piece of land?
Well, this is a very delicate debate. Palestine really, this was under the British mandate. They called this Palestine before the State of Israel was created. And then the Balfour Declaration in England, well, it was launched by the British, but before the UN, that was approved that it's time for the Jews to have their own homeland, which was the idea of Zionism, which essentially wasn't an imperialistic idea. They're just the right of Jews to have a homeland, especially after World War II. But since then, they've expanded, and there was a partition in 1948. So Palestinians had the right to a part of the land, and so did the Israeli Jews. The Israelis, well, it was not Israel yet, but the Jews in the area agreed to it. The Palestinians disagreed because the many Palestinians that were living in the Jewish section that was set aside under this UN partition plan, it wasn't clear what was going to happen to them. So they had valid reasons not to accept this partition plan, and yet often Israeli Zionists that are definitely in favor of expanding Israel, and they said, look, Palestinians, you had your shot at a country, you muffed it, sorry, it's too late now. So that was sort of the beginning. There was, a set aside for the Palestinians. But if we go back far enough in history, 2000 BC is when I have gone back as far enough studying archaeologists and historians. It's through Abraham who came in at that time. And the Muslims, the Arabs and the Jews seek heritage equally through Abraham. The Jews seek heritage through Isaac, Abraham's son, and the Arabs seek heritage through Ismail, another son, the son who came later, according to the Arabs. So, and it was still two sons of Abraham. So you can say that they're very connected. They're genetically very similar, the Arabs in the area and the Jews. And many Christians, because many of the Christians that were here before then converted. There were Jews here, and there were Christians later when Christianity came in, and a lot of Jews converted to Christianity, and then many Jews and Christians converted to Islam. But there's a huge mixture here, and it was very harmonious not long ago. I mean, after the State of Israel was created, there was tension and there were wars. Things calmed down and there was free mobilization of people, could go back and forth. There were no checkpoints and walls, say around the 50s and 60s. And then all of a sudden, the conservatives took over. There were walls and checkpoints and there was conflict. But it wasn't always like this. And that we can live in harmony. But a lot of people, I hate to say it, especially in the settlements, are making money from this occupation. The settlements that are on Palestinian lands, taken from the Palestinian lands, like the colonists in the U.S. that came and took the Indian lands. They've taken the lands and they've built them into industrial centers, and a lot of big American firms like HP and Motorola are there, and many others, making a lot of money. They don't outsource to China because they can get pretty cheap labor from the local Orthodox Jews there who didn't really work before. And they're loath to return the land to Palestinians because they're making money. So it's not just about land and culture and religion. It's about also making money and opportunities to make money that are sometimes blinding people to the idea of, but if we start giving back some of the lands, we do the land swaps, we can still create a durable peace here with real, sincere efforts. But unfortunately, the Israeli government, nor is our government, the U.S., are really sincerely want this. But, it's not just about the Trump administration. People are poking fingers at him. No. Under President Obama, there was very little change. He exacerbated a lot of the conflict by really not pushing for any type of agreement. There was no big difference between President Obama and President Trump. So, these people getting on the bandwagon and trashing Trump about that, other than making the idea, which Obama didn't do, of moving the embassy, which was wrong. Other than that, both Trump and Obama have supported everything that Israel wanted for the most part and given them the money and allowed Israel to act with impunity in this area.
I did a little research some time ago in regards to not the conflict so much, but the U.S.'s interest and involvement in trying to bring about peace. And I'm thinking, what president was it that was the first one to decide that we needed to stick our nose into their business over there? And unfortunately, it turns out it was actually President Carter who was the first one to try to bring the two factions together to try to hammer out some kind of lasting peace. And I've often thought over the years, and I say this only from the standpoint of a novice who has no clue. You know what's going on over there more than I do. But there was a part of me as I'm looking at the history, and I'm only going back to the 70s with, again, the Carter administration stepping in and saying, hey, we'd like to broker a peace between your two peoples. Let's see what we can work out. And one of the thoughts that came to my mind back in the late 90s was, these people don't want peace. They want to fight. So why don't we just step out of it and let them just work it out? And, you know, if it's going to be the Hatfields and McCoys, okay, fine, but let's not be a part of it. Similar to what we did in the 70s, I believe it was, where during the, the Israeli-Egyptian war? We were funding both sides, and I found out the reason why. Because if we funded both sides, Russia wouldn't be able to. And I'm thinking, that is the stupidest reason I've ever heard in my life.
That has so much to do with our assisting both Egypt and Israel, exacerbating a war effort simply to keep out another country. Yeah. I agree with you 100%. I really believe, sort of getting back to today,
sure,
I really believe that there are great efforts are being made, especially in this place here. It's a pivotal area. People say it's imminent, no matter what the world has been saying, even the European Parliament. Many countries have denounced Israel. I'll tell you what, I'm going to stay as long as I can. I'm working, and I don't care. The Israeli police, I'm actually in Area C right now. So, and they know probably I'm here. They can come in here and arrest me anytime and then put me back in prison and deport me. There's enough people here, I think, that we might prevent. So I think that's why they're deterred from doing it. But you know what? I want to make this announcement. I'm working with two lawyers that are very highly connected in Ramallah. And if anything happens here, and whether they destroy or not Kano Ekmar, these Bedouin communities, we have a very good case before the International Criminal Court. Now the state of Palestine can bring a case before the International Criminal Court, and I'm definitely going to bring in, you have to bring in individuals. Mm-hmm. I'll bring in Netanyahu, I'll bring in Lieberman, and perhaps even Trump as an accomplice for war crimes, for violation of the Geneva Convention. I'm not the only one who said that. The fourth Geneva Convention is being violated here by transferring, by destroying people's lands that you're occupying, as well as crimes against humanity, which is the International Criminal Court regulations. I'm going to continue working on it. I'm a French lawyer and an American lawyer, and I've practiced international law, and I'm going to stay with it as long as I can to bring the Palestinians to the International Court of Justice and bring Netanyahu. My goal is to bring Netanyahu and Lieberman to jail where they belong, just as much as the atrocities committed in Yugoslavia and Africa, where those people, some of them are serving a life sentence. This is so serious what's going on here. I'm not the only one that said that war crimes have been committed, as I said before, and crimes against humanity. I'm going to be working on it. And, of course, I'll be in Ramallah. That's in the Palestinian section. Mm-hmm. And it's less likely that the Israeli police will go in, even though they have gone into the Palestinian section and made arrests. I'm going to stay as long as I can to help the lawyers there to bring Netanyahu and Lieberman to justice. What they're doing is a serious crime. But I'm going to stay with it as long as I can, and if they do arrest me and they will deport me, I'll continue working on this until we get justice here.
Frank Romero is my guest. He is the author of Terror, Love and Terror in the Middle East, the fourth edition. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And I would ask you to consider the information that is being disseminated here on this program, and I also ask you to stay tuned. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I am Richard Dugan, your host, and I thank you for staying with us here on the program. As with all of our programs, all we're trying to do is understand what's going on. That's all we're trying to do. There are brighter minds than ours in many cases who know what's going on out there in the different areas of the world, and we're going to let them handle the logistics in that regard, because But what we want to try to do is bring to the forefront information and educate ourselves as to what is happening. One of the things that I'd like to talk with you now about, Frank, in this regard is, I asked you about the progress, if any, then two steps forward, yes, one step back kind of thing. But you shared with us something last time that has stayed with me. I've shared it on numerous occasions with people, both in the context of this radio broadcast as well as in conversations I've had with people. And even saying, hey, you know, this fellow whose name I at the time couldn't remember wrote the book Love and Terror in the Middle East. He shared with me how he's holding these interfaith groups with young people, both Israelis and Palestinians. And he's finding, and this is the way that I phrased it, and correct me if I've been misrepresenting it. I phrased it this way, that the kids basically are saying to mom and dad, you know that conflict you got, Hatfield and McCoy thing you got going on with the other side? That's yours. That's on you. We want no part of it. Am I correct in that summation? And is that still the case? And are you seeing more and more young people saying, we want something other than this thing that's been going on for way too long as part of our lives? We want to make something of our lives. We want to be creating something and not destroying.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I must say, after all the people you interview, you remember that. Of course, it was, I think, pivotal in our discussion, because I gave the analogy that it's more than the typical it's up to the children to clean up our messes. We need them to be educated. We always say that, right?
Yeah.
The next generation. Mm-hmm. No, it's far beyond that now. There's something happening with youth. Yes, there are militant youth. I mean, I was, to discuss this and then discard it. It was only 5 minutes away where I used to live in Paris, where the massacres took place. And yes, there were young, brainwashed terrorists that did that. But for the most part, youth worldwide are doing something that I've never seen, and this is the key. And they are stepping up. They're the ones that are stepping up and leading, and they're doing just like what you said. They're saying, look, they're sitting around in a circle, and this is just a manifestation of sort of what you're saying in a different way. They're listening to music, and they got their tattoos and their earrings and whatever, you know, and there might be a black person, an Arab looking Chinese, all these different ethnic groups. I'm listening to them. And, you know, when they're not texting, right, they're on the phone and they're actually experiencing this. I realize during their discussions, and I'm kind of like a peeping Tom, I'm listening in. They don't even care where that other person comes from, what color of their skin. They're focusing on the music, on the peace, on the vibration. And yes, to answer your question most directly, there's something happening among youth here that I don't think we've seen maybe since the 60s. You know, that is my generation, where the freaks, we used to get together and jam and do events, and the hippies and stuff, and the idea, the flower child, the peace and love stuff. But here, it's a tough world. These are tough kids. They've lived through it. They're far more educated than we were back in the 60s. And yet they're breaking the ice. They're getting together, doing stuff, talking stuff, listening to music, dancing, doing stuff. And I think through these efforts that they're making, they're stepping up, going far, much farther than us. We have a chance to bring a durable peace in the Holy Land, which I think is an epicenter again. If we don't find a durable peace here, the world will remain at war, and I still don't understand why that is the case. But I believe the youth here, crossing barriers, I mean, from Gaza, you have Arab youth connecting with Jews and Christians and Muslims, and Buddhists and Hindus and atheists and agnostics, and focusing on each other as human beings, and focusing on the music and not what they do, what money they make, but who they are and what they think. There's something new here, and that is the hope, Richard. And I see it, and I believe it, and I work toward that. The little scenario about bringing these evil people to justice, well, that's just part of my job as an international lawyer. It's not about revenge. It's literally about taking these people to court and putting them in jail. But the overall things that are happening here, the interface stuff that you allude to, which I'm glad we're getting back to, that's the fundamental, the nonviolent, protest, what we're doing here. It's like a love-in. people from all over the world are here. I've never seen a single argument. You have different people, different age groups here, basically youth. But you've got the old Bedouins, you know, talking with youth and getting together and the grassroots efforts. We have something in common, humanity. We have something in common, like the roots of the Avatar tree, and the youth is stepping up and showing us the way.
And I think that's fantastic. I have to say that I get a little tired of hearing that phrase, and the children or the youth are our future. They're not going to have a future if you destroy it. You know,
exactly.
That's the one thing that has always perplexed me is that attitude of they're our future, but yet, you know, there you are. You're playing these games with their future. You know, what is there going to be left in that regard? And that's what's so disappointing. I mean, I talk an awful lot on this program, too. And, you know, and again, this is not to disparage anybody who has chosen, who's made the life choice. Similar to what Israel does with its young people, you got to serve 2 years in the Israeli military, right?
Right. That's right. Male and female.
You've got these people that are serving, and you have people in the United States who they make the same kind of choice. Excuse me. Uh-huh. I sit here going, okay, you know, you're making this choice, but. Mm-hmm. To what end? I mean, do you really know what it is that you're going in? You know what you're getting yourself into? And I put it this way. You and I both are very familiar with, I'm sure, the state of our veterans and the fact that our government asks our citizens to go and perform these, to be a part of these conflicts. But then when they come back, and again, this is only an observation, they say, oh, that's nice. Thank you so much. Now get out of the way.
Get out of the way. Sorry, you need help. You need medical attention. Yes.
Yeah. And yet,
especially the Vietnamese vets.
Yeah.
Let me just intercede here.
Sure, please.
Just quickly, because I'm going to have to leave in about 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
But to give a more specific thing about veterans, and I'm glad you brought that up. There are lots of Israeli soldier veterans here.
Mm-hmm.
What are they doing? You just can Google Breaking the Silence. And combatants for peace. These are former Israeli soldiers, youthful Israeli soldiers that decided no. The way we're being trained is being very vicious. How we're treating the Palestinians will have nothing to do with it. And they're taking a hit because they're still in Israel. They're being harassed by their government. Their families, for the most part, are still supportive, but some of their families won't even talk to them anymore. The Israeli families, because these Israeli Jewish former soldiers that are supporting the Palestinians and trying to bring a conflict to an end are saying exactly what you said. We don't want to have any part of it. We will make the sacrifices. And believe me, they are making the sacrifices. And when I just give you an example of veterans working together, youthful veterans working together to make it a better world and walking the talk, when I was in prison, I tried to get a hold of friends because they only gave me about 3 minutes to talk to a lawyer, and then they didn't give me any chance to talk to a lawyer after that. Speaking of this wonderful democratic nation that Israel has turned out to be, I had no rights in prison. I was beat up. They put me in a cell with a bunch of hardened criminals, and things like that happened. But the first person that contacted me and I had met here was a former Israeli soldier who said, "What can I do?" And I said, "Look, I got 1 minute. Please contact people that I'm here and a lawyer." And she got the ball rolling. And she's a female, former Israeli soldier. And this is just to give you an idea how key these people have been for nonviolent resistance to the Israeli occupation and the cruel injustices that are perpetrated on the Palestinians.
Well, it seems to me like certainly there's a lot of work to do, but it also seems to me like there are a lot of people on all, I'm going to say three sides, who are interested in bringing about a calming of hostility and conflict and aggression and so forth in this region. And that would be a wonderful lesson for the rest of the world. And it is possible, but we have to change our thinking. What was it? It was Einstein who said that you cannot solve today's problems or challenges with the same mentality or intellect that created them. You've got to go to a higher level. And it sounds to me like the young people are coming at it from that perspective, as well as, again, as you alluded to, the veterans as well.
That's,
I applaud your efforts. I hope that you will stay safe, and I hope that we can stay in touch and bring an update as we travel into 2019 and hopefully a better year for everybody. And yes. I really do appreciate the fact that you've taken the time as well as risked your well-being in that regard to bring us this information. And again, this isn't a news program, but these are the kinds of things that we want to talk about, because there are solutions. There are better ways of living. Definitely. There is a new paradigm, and it sounds to me like you're helping to bring that about, and greatly appreciate it.
I'm glad to be a part of it. Thanks for sharing this this moment with me and your listeners and viewers. Do you want me to give you my website if people want to contact me and stuff like that? Or
it is Frank Romano loveandterror4.com, correct?
That's right. That's right. And you can get in touch with me that way. My email is frankfro, F-R-A-N-K, F as in Frank, R-O, at AOL.com. And, people don't agree with some of the things. I'm just happy to hear, share with people. I learn from people. I learn from critiques as well. So yeah. let's bring this world together. And this show is so important, Richard, and I hope I can get a link to this interview and I could put it and also share that with other people.
We will
and
be sending
we can interview again,
and we will be sending you the link to download the
thank
interview
you.
And we'll let
appreciate
you know when it's going to be airing as well. And
thank
again
you.
Frank, I thank you so much. Again, the book is entitled Love and Terror in the Middle East. It is the fourth edition. And I don't know if you have just another minute, Frank. I have three very quick questions that I ask
sure,
all of my guests
ahead.
I did ask you a year ago. Maybe the answers have changed. First question is, who is Frank Romano?
I'm a professor at the University of Paris, International Law and North American Literature. I'm also a member of the French Bar and the California Bar. But above and beyond all that, I'm here as an activist for reasons I've shared with you before. It really is a calling, and it's very much of a part of who I am. And I'm just glad to be a part of bringing, hopefully bringing a durable peace to the Holy Land, particularly between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And now I'm at an epicenter area here with the Bedouins that's turning out to be a pivotal place for these peace efforts.
And so you've sort of answered my second question, which is what you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now. So I'll go straight to the third question, which is, what is your life's purpose?
The work I've been doing, I'm actually sharing with people the maybe even the moral of the story of what I'm doing goes beyond even my calling for this to help to bring peace to this area, which is all about us. It's not just for a charity reason, but I'm also trying to share with people that everybody has a calling. And you, each person will need to find their own path. I don't have a monopoly on paths to take. I believe I'm getting closer to what my calling is. I'm trying to live it. I'm trying to walk the talk. But I'm really trying to share with people to follow their calling, listen to that, what it is, and take the necessary risks to do what it takes so you become faithful to that calling. And that is sort of what I'm trying to do, and I'm trying to share with people, encourage people to do that.
Frank Romano loveandterror4.com is the website. We encourage you to go there. You can also contact him through his email address, which we'll link to as well. Frank, once again, thank you so much. And again, stay safe, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thank you, Richard. I hope so. Take care.
I will. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.